Well, I'm just thrilled and delighted to see so many people at the Anjumani Farsi. I think this is we're breaking a record here tonight. So thanks for coming, and I'm pleased to introduce to you our guest for tonight, Professor Bruce Lincoln. And I'll read my blurb, which I shamelessly pilfered from his website. But I recommend that you take a look at the CV. As his blurb says, well, I'll go ahead and read it. His research emphasizes critical approaches to the study of religion, and he is particularly interested in issues of discourse, practice, power, conflict, and the violent reconstruction of social borders. His research tends to focus on the religions of pre-Christian Europe and pre-Islamic Iran, but he has a notoriously short attention span and has also written on a bewildering array of topics, including Guatemalan Cuanderismo, Lakota sun dances, Melanesian funerary rituals, Swazi kingship, the St. Bartholomew Day's massacre, Marco Polo, professional wrestling, Persian imperialism, the theology of George W. Bush, and comparative demonology. So, like I said, take a look at the CV. It's quite bewildering. His most recent publications include Between History and Myth, Stories of Harold Fairhair and the Founding of the State, which is this year, 2013, Happiness for Mankind, A Cayman in Religion and the Imperial Project, Gods and Demons, Priests and Scholars, Critical Explorations in the History of Religions, Religion, Empire, and Torture, The Case of Achaemenid Persia. And the latter book on Achaemenid Persia was awarded the Frank Moore Cross Award for the most substantial volume related to ancient Near Eastern and Eastern Mediterranean epigraphy, text, and or tradition as the result of original research published during the last 2 years by the American Society of Oriental Research. And the last time he came, which I think was 2 years ago, he gave one of the most memorable talks I can remember about, it was a brief introduction for the uninitiated into the ethics of Zoroastrianism. And his topic for today is, I didn't write it down, so I have to remember it. It's about the Magi. So, Befanwai,
Chediman. Thank you. Let me pass these around. The first is a handout that includes most of the materials I'm going to be addressing, including what turned out to be an absolutely illegible version of an Achaemenid seal that I blew up and played with the contrast, and there's one where you can actually see what's on it. With that preamble, it seems to me the starting point for any discussion of the Magi is, you know, a piece of linguistics, philology. You know, Greek magos and Latin magus transparently, you know, are loan words and representations of the term attested in Old Persian, magush. In Old Persian, it is the title of a priest, and in Greek and Latin, that noun has a very curious bifurcation within it. Sometimes it refers to Persian priests, and when it does so with great respect, particularly in the Platonic dialogues, it shows up that way. And the priests are described as practicing what the Greeks refer to as terapeia theon, care of the gods. And they are revered for their wisdom. They're sages of the Orient. In most other texts, however, that very same noun, in Greek or in Latin, references the absolutely most dubious scoundrels. Sorcerers, charlatans, casters of spells, tellers of fortunes, untrustworthy, you know, hucksters, essentially. There also is a whole set of derived adjectives and abstract nouns. In Greek, mageia, magikos, maguo, and a number of others. And all of that derived terminology reflects the second usage. It's, you know, what we get, I mean, the term magic comes ultimately from that pejorative reworking of the terminology that's borrowed from Iran. It's a stereotyped discourse of magic that posits it as something scurrilous and originating with Iranians. Now, in order to make sense of how that happened and what it means, it seems to me that you have to start with the Iranian evidence, which is, unfortunately, much slimmer than most people realize, classicists in particular, but even Iranists. And so just to be clear, let me summarize, you know, what there is from Iran that speaks to the issue of the Magi. First, from the Avesta, the older Zoroastrian scriptures. For many years, it was thought that one word that occurs one time in the Avesta, this is a compound, Mogu Tbish, which occurs in the Yasna. The second element means hostile or enemy, that's transparent. And Iranists thought the first element, Mogu, was cognate with Magus. And it denoted the Magi priesthood, and that somehow this text was talking about people or groups that were enemies of the Magi. Nearly 50 years ago, Emil Benvenista absolutely conclusively demonstrated that that's mistaken. The passage, which is kind of bland, but it includes a series of terms, of which this is one that resembles the others, and the structure of the passage makes absolutely certain it cannot refer to a priest. Rather, it refers to a level of social integration in order for it to be parallel with the others. So the Avesta essentially holds zero that is relevant to the Magi. The Achaemenid inscriptions are a little better, but only a little better. There is one man who is referred to as a Magush. This is a very important figure that turns up in the great inscription of Darius at Bisitun, the inscription where Darius describes the struggle through which he became king of the Persian Empire. And the man who is called a Magush is his predecessor on the throne, who is, in fact, the cardboard villain of a very carefully worked out piece of propaganda. As most historians now realize, the man whom Darius assassinated and replaced on the throne was, in fact, Bardia, son of Cyrus the Great, to whom Darius then gave the name Galmata the Magush, and he accused him of having secretly killed Bardia and then impersonated him. And so, although everybody thought it was Bardia that Darius killed, it was actually this imposter and usurper, this sneaky, creepy Magush, who had taken the place of the real king. What that fiction accomplishes, besides making Darius the heroic restorer of proper kingship, rather than what he actually was, the usurper and assassin, it doubly discredits his predecessor. If the man on the throne was a Magush, for two different reasons, he had no right to rule. One, he was a Mede and not a Persian. Two, he was a priest and not a warrior aristocrat. And so if we accept Darius's account, just before he took the throne, there was this terrible period when a man unfit to rule had seized the throne and carried out a masquerade, and thank God Darius rescued us from all of that. What this tells us about the Magi is slim but important. They were priests, and they have some association with Median rather than Persian descent and identity. It's really only with the archaeological remains from Persepolis that we begin to get something that is, you know, genuinely, you know, useful in its description, starting with the seal that, you know, you have on that second handout. The seal shows two priests, one of whom is at the far left and rather obscured. The one on the right is much more visible. One of them holds twigs standing before a fire, and the other is more oriented toward a mortar and pestle that sit on a table next to the altar. This second priest, the one with the mortar and the pestle, can be identified as a Magush by the headgear that he wears. If you can see on that copy of the seal, he's wearing a very distinctive hat that has flaps that will cover his mouth. Strabo, the Greek geographer, describes the Magi of Cappadocia, you know, Asia Minor, as wearing hats of precisely that sort, made of felt, with flaps that cover the mouth so that the breath of the priest will not defile the fire or other sacred aspects of the sacrificial ritual. Now, this is described for no one except the Magi. And so we're reasonably certain that this shows us Magi at work. The scene represents preparations for a sacrificial offering of hauma, you know, the intoxicating drink that's pounded in the mortar and pestle to extract its juice from the plant. And this is a ritual that was commonly performed at Persepolis, the Achaemenid capital, as is evidenced by the many mortars and pestles that are found there with inscriptions as to who used them in which ceremonies and whatnot. Persepolis also contained the administrative records that are known as the fortification tablets, where individuals who are identified as Magi appear in 33 of the published texts, and a good many more that have not yet been published. Of the published ones, all 33 occurrences enumerate supplies that were given to individual Magi from the imperial apparatus, and these were either specified to be used in what's called the land sacrifice. The land sacrifice goes to all gods or can be used for any god. It doesn't have a specific recipient attached. And that is 23 of the 33 occurrences, 70% of the total. And in the other 10, for sacrifices to specific gods who are identified by name. As those statistics suggest, Magi were closely associated with the land sacrifice in particular. This is the most prominent of all the Achaemenid rituals. It was performed every month, and in some locales it seems it may even have been performed daily. It's received considerable attention in recent years, most exhaustively from Walter Henkelmann, and Henkelmann has established that the land had a deep Elamite prehistory, that it could be performed by several different kinds of priests, but most commonly was performed by a Magush. It might be offered to various deities who are normally not specified. And it also was supported by the royal treasury, which gave generous supplies of beer, wine, grain, fruit, and meat, usually on an annual basis, to the priests who were entrusted with performing the land sacrifice. Henkelmann further shows that the goods were presented to the deities within a ritual context, and after the ceremonies were complete, they became the property of the priests and they were consumed by the priests. It's thus the case that all of this meat and beer and so forth and so on was simultaneously offerings for the gods and a stipend or a salary of sorts for the priests. That arrangement, and that same arrangement is true for sacrifices offered at the royal tombs, as those are described in other texts. But that kind of arrangement suggests something that I think is of cardinal importance for understanding the situation of the Magi. Within the Achaemenid imperial order, they enjoyed royal patronage, such that their priestly labors provided them with a steady income. They were on salary. They were thus able to devote themselves, by virtue of royal support, to the practice of sacrifice, and also, most probably, to theoretical speculation attendant to the sacrifice and based on the details of sacrificial ritual. Recent work in comparative philology has helped us to refine our understanding of the Magush. Building on a splendid insight of Jean Quellens, who cleared up a couple of lingering problems that had previously obstructed research, Hans-Peter Schmidt and Almut Hintze have explored a set of terms in both Indic and Iranian that are closely related to Magush. This is older Avestan Maga and Vedic Maga, with an H in the Vedic. And these specifically describe the principle of reciprocity that's operative within Indo-Iranian sacrifice. As Hintze further observed, the adjectives, Magavan, which occurs both in Avestan and in Vedic, are used only of the patron of the sacrifice and the deity who receives the sacrifice, never of the priest. Magu refers to the priest, but never the deity or the patron. Apparently, those terms characterize actors who collaborated in the performance of sacrifice in a triangular system that's, outlined on the second page of the handout. Some of them, the gods and the patrons, are actors whose wealth and power permitted them to contribute material assets to a process of sacrificial exchange. In contrast, the third actor, that is to say the priest, contributed the non-material aspects necessary for sacrifice. This includes mastery of sacred speech, ritual theory, and the details of practice. It is in that capacity, as master of the speech and action constitutive of sacrifice, that he is designated Magu, acting in collaboration with gods and patrons who are designated Magavan. As Hintze describes the system, quote, all three participants were interdependent. The gods required the poet's praise. The poet needed the patron to employ and pay him, while the patron needed both the poet to interact with the gods and the gods to renew his prosperity. The ordinary man was not able to enter into a direct relationship with the deity, but had to hire a priest, who by performing the ritual could do this on the patron's behalf. Only the poet priest was in a position to interact with the gods, so that the latter might confer on the patron what the patron desired. Now, Hintze stressed the fact that the gods are dependent on priests, not for material sustenance, but rather for the praise that they offer in meticulously crafted hymns that they composed and sang. Neither the fortification tablets nor the old Persian inscriptions connect the Magi to song. Indeed, none of these sources give any information about any aspect of the ritual practice. But the sacrificial hymns of the Avesta and the Vedas were all meant to be chanted. And numerous classical sources connect Magian sacrifice strongly with song. The earliest and most important of those passages is the text from Herodotus that I give you on the handout from Book 1, 131, where he says, quote, among the Persians, it is not permitted for the sacrificer to pray for good things for himself alone. So he prays for good to come into being for all the Persians and for the king, as the sacrificer is himself included in the phrase, all the Persians. Then, having cut the victim into pieces, limb from limb, he boils the meat, and having strewn the softest grass, particularly clover, he then places all the meat carefully on top of this. When this is arranged, a man, a magus, standing beside him, chants a theogony. They say the song is of that sort. For it is not their custom to perform sacrifices without a magus. Having waited a little while, the sacrificer carries off the pieces of meat and uses them as he pleases. Now, a number of features from that account are familiar from what I've had to say previously. These include the triangular relations of king, sacrificer, and deity, and also the way the sign value, here the spirit of the offering, is given to the gods while the use value, that is the meat, is reserved for the officiant. Also noteworthy and of particular interest at the moment is the song performed by the Magus, which is explicitly and emphatically identified as a theogony. And that term, I think, should be taken literally, for it is an account of creation and not to praise him of a specific deity that the Magus sings while meticulously placing all the pieces, the dismembered parts of the victim, for display and examination. This is no accident, as I've argued elsewhere, for the relation of sacrifice to creation is one of the master themes in ancient Indo-Iranian religion. Sometimes creation is realized through the first sacrifice, and we have myths of creation through sacrifice. Sometimes it's theorized that each repetition of sacrificial ritual repeats, renews, or reverses the creation. And sometimes, at a more philosophical level, it's theorized that sacrificial dismemberment models the cosmogonic transition from the one to the many. It's that last pattern that dominates Achaemenid religion, where creation accounts stand at the head of 23 different royal inscriptions. This is the very first paragraph, the first thing that's stated in all of them. And the formulaic creation myth describes how the wise lord, Ahura Mazda, established four ideal phenomena at the beginning of time: earth, sky, man, and happiness, all of which are consistently named in the singular. Each one has attributed to it, then, primordial unity as a sign of its perfection, a unity that is shattered when the powers of evil assault creation, the Achaemenid version of that being referred to as the lie. And when the lie attacks creation, unity is disrupted, and each of these four perfect primordial creations atomize. As a result, Earth is divided into countless different terrains and polities, each with its own distinctive qualities and imperfections. Similarly, at the level of the human, the primordial, original, unitary man is replaced by nationalities, races, classes, difference of various sorts, all of which contribute to conflict, confusion, the problems of existence in the present moment. And absolute total happiness, again, consistently named in the singular in the account of creation, is replaced by all of the varieties of flora, fauna, material substances, each of which has its own peculiarities, each of which has its own utility, each of which is capable of giving very specific sorts of pleasure or pain, and each of which is put in a different locale. The great project undertaken by the Achaemenid Empire was restoration of original perfection as created by the wise lord, which involved reunification of all the good things that are now scattered across the globe. That ambition informed numerous endeavors, including the construction of palaces, making use of the most precious substance from each of the provinces, the royal table, which was supposed to have the best foods from all different locales, and the paradise gardens, which were supposed to assemble all the plants and all the animals of every different species and group them together in an absolutely pristine, perfect setting. These and other practices, also more broadly, in the empire's expansion to encompass the entire globe and its extraction of tribute by which it took the different precious substances of the provinces and brought them to the center. In all of those practices, the issue of diversity figures first as a problem, something to be cataloged and studied, and second as something to be transcended and reversed through all of these processes of imperial reunification. Now, given all of that by way of background, it's quite intriguing to encounter what is consciously described as a magical text that is structured along lines that reflect the very same concerns as do Achaemenian banquets, gardens, palaces, tribute, and so forth. The text in question bears the title Kairokmeta, which means handiworks. It's a text that no longer exists. It was lost in the fire of the Alexandrian library. But it was fortunately summarized in some detail by Pliny in his Natural History in the chapters devoted to magic, a history of magic. Pliny attributed the authorship of this text to the pre-Socratic philosopher Democritus, whom he, like many others, described as a student of the Magi and the first Greek to have taught and written on the subject of magic. You know, for Pliny and a lot of the classical world, Democritus is the tradent who brings magic to the West. Other sources, including the Latin author Columella, more plausibly assign the Kairokmeta to a different authorship. And Columella identifies a scribe who worked at the library of Alexandria, one Bolus of Mendes, who was active in the 2nd century and wrote a host of texts, frequently adopting the pseudonym of Democritus. Whatever its origins, whatever its ultimate sources, there are a number of features in Pliny's summary of the Kairokmeta that I believe reflect Persian traditions and styles of thought. Most immediately, Kairokmeta catalogs 14 exotic plants, each of which has its own unique properties, uses, and geographic origins. And I give you a table summarizing Pliny's summary there. The list begins with a plant named the Aglaophotis, which means brilliant radiance. It's said to be a plant from Arabia that is outstanding in its color, and the Magi use it for invoking the gods. Second is a plant named Achaemenis, the Achaemenid plant, which is leafless, amber-colored. It grows in India, and it prompts visions of deities. Those visions are described as powerful and intimidating, and they work in two very distinct sorts of ways, both of which, however, helped kings in their royal duties. On the one hand, this plant is administered to criminals, whom it forces to confess their crimes. On the other hand, it's smeared on the swords of foreigners, and when that's done, it forces the enemy to flee in battle. Along with the Arianus, the Arian plant, this is the only one whose name reflects Persian origins. All of the others are Latinized constructions based on Greek originals through which Pliny or someone else, referred to these plants. But Pliny tells us that behind the Greek lay something else. For in the text that he consulted, on which he based his summary, he says, that text, quote, set down the Magian designations of all these plants, which Pliny, alas, did not cite for us. In addition to the Achaemenis, two other plants induce visions, but each in a distinctive fashion. Just as the Achaemenis produces visions of divine powers, varias numinum imaginationes, powers that make the guilty confess and enemies run, so the Ophiusa, the serpentine plant, which is found in Elephantinae, yields visions of snakes that prompt anyone guilty of sacrilege to commit suicide. The Thalassegle, sea radiance plant, from the river Indus, conjures up wonders, miraculous, that result in states of divine possession. Other differences notwithstanding, all three plants are positive in their effects, as they help to establish or restore justice in the first instance, making criminals confess, holiness in the second instance, making, you know, those who have committed sacrilege commit suicide, and inspiration, establishing direct contact between humans and gods in the third. Ordinarily, each territory is represented by one plant only, and vice versa. There are, however, a few exceptions. Thus, the Theongelus plant, the divine messenger, which the Magi use in divination, flourishes on mountain peaks of Syria and Crete, two different places, but the height brings them closer to the gods in both instances. And they're also found in the cities of Babylon and Susa, imperial centers close, you know, to the heart of the empire. Altogether, 16 regions are mentioned, but only three are associated with more than one plant. The three are Persia, the absolute center of the empire, India and Ethiopia, the outermost extremities to the east and the west, respectively, are the others. And in each case, a geographic subcategorization accounts for the duplication. Thus, for instance, Elephantine, which is in northern Ethiopia, is home to the Ophiuchus, the serpent vision plant. Meroe, located in the far south of Ethiopia, produces the Ethiopus, the Ethiopian plant, which is said to have the power to dry up streams and ponds and also to cure dropsy, that is, retention of fluid. Clearly, that plant, like its distinctive territory in the far south, was understood to be characterized by excessive dryness and to have the power to combat an excess of fluid. Similarly, the Arianus plant in Ariana, off in East Asia, was possessed of extraordinary heat. It's said to be fiery in color. It was to be collected only when the sun is in Leo, that is, you know, late July, early August, the hottest part of the summer. And the touch of this plant would make wood burst into flame spontaneously. One could continue to map the relations among all these plants. Schematically, they play on the binary oppositions north-south, east-west, center-periphery, land-water, high-low, light-dark, hot-cold, and moist-dry. And fascinating though the details are, the general system of contrasts, the structure of conceptualization, is much more important. The master principle of this text is that each plant is extraordinary in its powers, uniquely associated with the land of its origin, and able to create a specific good and or redress a specific evil. At the level of vegetation, the text catalogs the pieces of absolute, unqualified, unified, primordial happiness that were scattered across the globe when original perfection was lost. Magian wisdom, then, included detailed knowledge of these and other plants, their location, appearance, elementary qualities, and above all, how each one could be used to help restore an ideal world. Descriptions of three individual plants confirm that we are dealing with Iranian traditions and not Greek materials endowed with a superficial Iranian patina. The first of these is the Theombrotion, a plant whose name means the food of the gods, which is a peacock-colored, sweet-smelling plant that grows in the river Coaspes, which is said to have the power to heal all of the king's ailments of body and mind, and also to secure justice. As I've tried to show elsewhere at greater length, the locus, appearance, and effects of that plant suggest its connection to the ideology of what in Iranian sources is called frasha, wonder, marvel, perfection, either primordial perfection or eschatological perfection, when the world is exactly as God wants it to be, free from all pollution and absolutely whole in its unity. It's also comparable to mythic plants of the Zoroastrian tradition, especially the one referred to as the tree of all healing, that possesses all the powers of all vegetation to deal with all illnesses and set everything right. Second is the plant referred to as the Cossack Netes. You know, the name means sister. This is the sole plant for which no place of origin is given and no use specified. But its name, plus the fact that it is said to grow only among plants of its own species, suggest its association with the endogamous forms of marriage favored by Persians, brother-sister marriage, or child-parent marriage, that scandalized Greek authors who regarded it as incest. Finally, there's the Hermesias plant, which is not so much a plant, but a mixture of beneficent substances that combine to create and nurture new lives, perfect in body and in spirit. And I'll read you Pliny's description. It says, Hermesias is not a plant, but a compound that produces children who are beautiful and good. It's made from pounded kernels of the pine nut, together with honey, myrrh, saffron, and palm wine, then mixed with the Theombrotion, divine food plant, and milk. Democritus prescribes that this be drunk by those who would conceive children. Then they should drink it again after conception, and it should also be drunk by nursing mothers. In this way will be made excellent souls and good bodies. Every item of that mix could be discussed in detail. It includes sweet, nurturing fluids, precious aromatics and spices, strong healing agents, and one should also note that the first named of the components, the pine nuts, are beaten or pounded to extract their essence, much as haoma is treated in Iranian sacrificial rituals. David Flattery has already compared Pliny's description of the Hermesias to Avestan texts that promise the birth of perfect sons to those who perform the haoma sacrifice. And there's a great deal more to be said along those lines. Inter alia, one should note that haoma offerings were accompanied by song, intended to heal and renew all of creation, and they involved mixing the pounded plant with milk, pure water, pomegranate juice, and other life-enhancing substances. Here, as throughout its contents, the Cairo Kmeta seems aware of Iranian ritual practices and a system of knowledge that is built on those practices. Now, Pliny took care to summarize the Cairo Kmeta in considerable detail. And within the long passage where he recounts these 14 different plants, he scrupulously abstains from any editorial comment. Elsewhere in the Natural Histories, however, he dismisses all of the claims that are made in that text, calling them, quote, the empty beliefs of magic, magicae vanitates. And he sees these as preposterous exaggerations, so much so that they threaten to undermine good Roman citizens' faith in the real healing powers that plants actually have. This is consistent with his view of magic as, quote, the most fraudulent of all the arts. And it's part of his purpose to show how this colossal fraud made its way from Persia to the West. But according to his story, magic originates in Persia, where it is a debased offshoot of medicine that goes on then to encompass equally debased styles of religion and of mathematics, astrology in particular. And in this triple form, bad medicine, bad religion, and bad mathematics, it was carried west by the Magi. The students of the Magi, Democritus being the first of them, then transmit it further westward. And they establish magic in the Mediterranean at the same moment that Hippocrates introduces medicine. And medicine is to magic as Democritus is to Hippocrates, as bad science is to good, and bad religion is to good. The enthusiasts of magic misrepresent it, according to Pliny, as, quote, a higher and more sacred, unquote, form of healing than is available through through medicine. And in that form, magic arouses unrealistic hopes, it preys on elemental fears, and it attracts the gullible. For Pliny, the relation of magic to medicine is much like that of a bastard to a legitimate sibling. Whenever he's talking about medicine, magic is implicitly at issue. Whenever he's talking about magic, medicine is implicitly at issue. And the opening passage of Book 24, it deals with the transition from medicine to magic. It starts with medicine. It ends with the summary of the Chirokometa. That's the climax to which, you know, that book builds. And at the very beginning, he says, apropos of medicine, quote, and this is on the handout, "Neither the woods nor the rougher face of nature are destitute of medicine. Nowhere has the sacred mother of all things failed to distribute remedies for people, so that the wilderness itself still produces medicines, with wonders of sympathy and antipathy appearing everywhere. From this was medicine born. It pleased nature for these things alone to be the remedies that are acquired everywhere, easy to discover and without expense, from which we live. Later, deceivers among men and the profiteering of clever people devised workshops where it is promised to everyone that an extension or an enhancement of their own life is available for sale. Straight away, inexplicable compounds and mixtures are invoked, Arabian and Indian remedies that are valued highly, and the medicine for a small sore is priced as if it came from the Red Sea, although even the poorest person consumes true remedies daily. And if people would only seek an herb or a shrub from their gardens, none of the arts would be cheaper than medicine." The argument, I think, is clear and sharp. Proper medicine is simple, local, cheap, and easy. It works with plants that are found everywhere. It's the product of a benevolent nature referred to as the sacred mother of all things. Magical substance contrast in pointed fashion. The Hermesius that we talked about earlier provides the most pointed example of this. You know, all of the substances are precious, expensive in the extreme. One could also cite the Helianthes, the sunflower plant, and the which comes from Themiscyrene and the mountains of Cilicia. This is something that is boiled in palm wine with saffron and the fat of a lion in the mix to perfect the healing substance of the plant itself. And in that form, it yields an unguent, which is reserved for the magi and for kings. And they anoint their bodies with this substance to make them more beautiful, more radiant. In both the Hermesius and the Helianthes, the substance in question is complicated, artificial, imported, and tremendously expensive. What it promises, moreover, is not just a cure for whatever happens to ail you, but the realization of some extraordinary form of perfection. Even when the magic plants are not treated in elaborate ways or recombined in complex concoctions, they still promise equally extravagant results. Communication with the gods, in the case of the Agleophotis, the Thalassegle, and the Theangelus. Mastery of animals, in the case of the Adamantus and the Therionarcha. Perfection of the world through the establishment of perfect truth, the Achaemenes, perfect justice, the Ambrotion, religion, the Ophiusa, or festivity and laughter, in the case of the Protomedia and the Galatophoulos. None of this, however, comes cheap. For each of the plants that has such powers is rare, exotic, precious, coming from climes far removed from Rome or Greece. Those who have, or even those who just pretend to have, knowledge of those substances and how to use them, offer their services at a great, great price. Worse still, according to Pliny, they're foreigners. And the foreign tinge of magic leads him to cast this as nothing less than a national security issue. You know, on the second passage I have there, states, truly it is thus. In their greatness, the Roman people have lost their old habits, and we are conquered in the act of conquering. We submit to foreigners, and by one of their arts, that is magic, they rule over the rulers. Now, although I find Pliny's contrast of medicine and magic as antithetical systems, something overly schematic, just too neat and too perfect, that construction still, I think, helps us to understand the transformation of Persian priests into self-proclaimed wonder workers of dubious repute. In part, that metamorphosis took place inside the tendentious Western imaginary. It's a shift of opinion, you know, from a fantasy of sages to a fantasy of scoundrels. Asian in both instances. But it's not entirely inside the Western imaginary. What we're talking about is the way the Magi were perceived and described, which changed over time. But that shift in perception and rhetoric interacted with shifts in the way the Magi understood and represented themselves. And more importantly, changes in the way they made their living. And it's that change in the mode of production, of priestly, religious, or magical production, that I think is of prime importance. The crucial fact is that the Magi lost royal patronage when Alexander the Great conquered the Achaemenid Empire. In that moment, the Magian priests are deprived of their income, security, and base of operations. In the radically changed circumstances of the Hellenistic era, they were forced to convert such capital as they possessed. And I want to suggest that that capital took the form of knowledge. Knowledge derived from centuries of speculation on sacrificial rituals and their associated cosmogonic traditions. Their capital also included a reputation for esoteric knowledge. And within the Achaemenid court, their knowledge and their reputation secured them ongoing patronage. When that was lost, they had to transform these into practices and products that could be sold piecemeal in whatever terrain they happened to traverse. In this historically salient example, the distinction between priest and magician is thus not primarily between two different forms of knowledge power, nor is it primarily a distinction between different perspectives from which the same actors are viewed and evaluated. Most important is the distinction between two different modes and two different sets of relations for constituting certain content as knowledge and converting that knowledge to profit. The historically earlier Magian form, centered in Achaemenid, at the Achaemenid court, was based on patronage, a triangular system that bound magi, kings, and gods together in ongoing relations of exchange. In pointed contrast, in diaspora, the system of the magi was based on entrepreneurship, commodification, and sporadic transactions of buyer and seller. In the elementary forms of the religious life, Emil Durkheim famously observed that whereas priests have congregations, magicians have a clientele. That formula, I think, works quite well for modernity, but it needs a certain adaptation for the ancient world. There, I think it's more often the case that priests didn't have congregations, they had patrons. The patrons most often being the king or the state. And within the system of patronage, they claimed privileged access to the gods. Magicians, in contrast, didn't have patrons. And it wasn't the gods so much that they trafficked with. What they had instead was commodities, cures, charms, solutions to practical problems that afflict everyone. Everyone who might become a client. And what they also had was a seductive, but also a very suspect line of sales pattern. That's where I would leave things. If there's anything here you'd like to discuss, I'm happy to field questions and talk about it as long as you'd like. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
One question about the transformation of the magicians. What kind of evidence do we have of the latter form of, you know, the magicians as entrepreneurs? And where is this from?
It's in the West. It's in the Greek and Latin sources, where those people who are called magi are knocking on doors, you know, congregating in the agora, peddling, you know, charms, trinkets, you know, cures, what have you. It's this second use when the Greek and Latin term magos doesn't mean a Persian priest. It means one of those funny guys who's in your neighborhood trying to sell you, you know, some supernatural stuff.
Right.
And someone you probably ought to be suspicious of.
So they no longer have a ritual role.
It's not attested if they do.
Right. But this is in the West, so it is still possible that they had some kind of ritual role in the Persian lands.
I suppose anything's possible. They really disappear.
But they disappear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there evidence or any other indication that some sort of collegiate structure is developed? I mean, was it many individuals practicing the same thing? Or was it like a guild that the king went to and for a specific ailment went for a specific magi?
I wish I could answer that. The evidence is, I mean, the properly Iranian evidence is in the fortification tablets. And just the king authorizes send 20 bushels of grain, you know, 10 jugs of beer, and 12 sheep to Magush X. That's it. I mean, we've got the storeroom records. They're not interested in the ideology or in the, you know, organization of the institution. It's just the payroll. I mean, one suspects that there's, I don't know if there's a collegiate institution, but there's probably shared discourse. You know, they talk to one another, they, you know, deal with the same sorts of practical issues, they engage in speculation stimulated by one another, but we have no records that confirm that actually happened. It's just, you know, I think a reasonable hypothesis, and nothing speaks to it one way or the other. Well, the three magi, yes. Also, I mean, if you move to the West, you know, the Gospels give you the three traveling together and, you know, checking one another on which star they're talking about and where they can find it. And in Herodotus in particular, also to a lesser extent in Xenophon and some other Greek authors, there are accounts of the Magi in the plural, consulting to interpret royal dreams or to perform specific sacrifices or purifications, that they act, you know, collectively rather than individually. And I think Herodotus probably has it right, but again, it's not an indigenous Iranian source.
Yeah. So I was wondering where you would place Shakespeare's Friar Lawrence in the union of priest and magician, although the word Magi is not used.
No, but he certainly deals in potions and poisons and exotic goods and spells. My guess is that he would not wish to be called a magician, that it would be a term his enemies might use to condemn some of the things that he's doing, and that the more of those things he does, the more vulnerable he is to that charge. It's not a term anybody uses for himself after about the 2nd century. And Friar Lawrence is a wonderful example. Anything else? Yeah.
Another question.
Please.
You mentioned that Pliny condemns the Magian practices as debased medicine, debased math, and debased religion.
Yeah.
What is religion here?
Boy. I think he's probably working with a typical Roman model of what religio is, as opposed to superstitio. And that would mean carrying out Roman rituals faithfully in the temples of the appropriate gods, according to the customs that Romans referred to as the mos maiorum, the traditions handed down from our ancestors. The Romans are willing to accept Eastern cults. Magna Mater, Cybele, Isis, and others make their way to Rome and get temples established. They're recognized, but always viewed with a certain suspicion because those Asians are likely to slip into magic, deceptions. And they're watched carefully to make sure that their practices are consistent with the etiquette, I think, that Romans take to be dignified and proper for approaching the gods. Is that?
Yeah.
When do the biblical ones become kings?
I haven't looked at the Latin. It's possible that it's there. It's certainly not in the Greek New Testament. And St. Jerome may be responsible for that, but I honestly don't know. It could be much later. Anybody got a copy of the Latin New Testament here? No.
There also aren't three ever mentioned in the Gospels, right? That's a later...
Or Magi.
Magi. Are they not called Magi?
There's never three of them, to my knowledge, to not... That's a later...
He
says wise.
Sophoi?
Says, yeah.
Wise. Is that it?
The Greek, it's on my...
I should have checked that, and I didn't. I thought the Greek text says magoi. I believe so, but I'm, now that I'm challenged on it, I'm less than 100% certain. I think the Greek has magoi. Yeah.
When you were discussing Pliny and his, I guess, interpretation of the magi as kind of peddlers, these expensive magical concoctions,
yep.
It made me kind of reflect... I don't know, modern medicine seems a lot like that, right?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that? It's kind of like a reversal in a way. Modern medicine, this thing that I guess is Western.
My thoughts are fairly simple. Pliny blames the magi, or magicians, for inflating the price. And healing ought be cheap and readily available. That's the way Mother Nature, whom he divinizes as a benevolent, you know, deity, intended healing to be there for anyone in their own backyard. And Pliny argues that's the way it really is, but the profit motive enters with these exotic strangers who have a certain charisma that permits them to bamboozle good, honest, hardworking citizens, as a result of which the price of healing becomes enormously inflated. I think if you substitute drug companies for magi, and grant that both the magi and the drug companies know something, you know, it's not complete, you know, fiction and pretense, but the profit motive distorts what ought be a readily available, benevolent, kind, and caring world into a place where the rich prosper, the poor suffer, and the frauds, you know, thrive and prey on the gullibility of everyone. I find that recognizable. Does that speak?
So you're saying essentially they started that trend?
No. Pliny accuses them of having started it. I think that trend has been there as long as there's been commerce. Yeah.
So in the Greek, Matthew 2, it is magi.
Okay.
And in the Latin, it's magi.
Okay. Well, so kings must enter, you know, in some other, I would presume it's some early Christian variant, maybe one of the church fathers or something. But the scripture itself, the gospel text, makes them magi, not kings. That's consistent somewhat with the Greek etymology. Zarathustra, whom Pliny and others accuse as being the father of all magic. That name in Iranian means he whose camels are getting old. Zoroastres, the Greek rendition of that, contains astres, stars. And they associate him, they paint him as the first magician and the master of astrology and other things. And the New Testament portrait of the Magi as following the star is consistent with that stereotype of the Persian wise men. Yeah.
So the internet, for whatever use you may want to use it for, is claiming that the kings is a 6th century creation.
Uh-huh.
And it's used to justify Jesus being called King of Kings, that it's part
of
the tradition.
Oh, that the kings of the world come and do homage to him. And
yes.
Submit. Okay, that makes sense.
I don't know if that's accurate or not, but...
6th century seems to me entirely plausible. But it's not in the gospel text. It's an elaboration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about this sort of obsession with binary structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that you were mentioning how the kind of sort of ideology plays on these to deal with reuniting, flowing, while the Plisky bring it back up to the
mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know how much we can say about this, but this sort of obsession with binaries seems to be everywhere, right? In terms of pre-modern.
Levi-Strauss argues that's the way the human mind works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's comparable to, you know, Boolean, you know, figures that are the basis of computer technology, zero or one, off or on, that's all you need, and you know, the rest of the universe follows.
I mean, so would you see, in terms of like accommodated ideologies, would you see that as making a particular use of this structure? But
Yeah, there's no question.
But there's not, it's not an issue of saying like all of Galenic medicine and whatnot, and these other sorts of uses of humors. I mean, would you say there's an Ebonian origin to those, or that's just another sort of
analysis
development?
Oh, my.
That's not
totally. I'm going to separate this into two questions. One, binary contrasts are good to think. They're convenient, they're clear, they're flexible, and lots of people use them in lots of ways. You know, I don't think they're the solution to everything. But to contrast heaven and earth, you know, land and sea, male and female, young and old, us and them, you know, these are common places that recur, not just in antiquity, but all over the place. More specifically, you alluded to Galenic and behind that Hippocratic medicine, which is predicated on the contrast of hot, cold, moist, dry, and the four humors, each of which instantiates one from column A and one from column B. You know, the humors are hot, dry, hot, moist, cold, dry, cold, moist. And with those elementary, you know, building blocks, the Hippocratics, followed by Galen, construct an entire theory of the body and its well-being. Middle Persian texts committed to writing in the 9th century, but reflecting much older traditions. And how much older, I don't know, but at least back to the Sasanian era, show that same system, that same structure. There are two possibilities. This is a result of the influence of Greek medicine and Greek science in Iran, either at the Sasanian or perhaps even at the Achaemenid court, where we know that Greek physicians practiced on the King of Kings. That, I think, is the easier argument to make stick. Alternatively, some have argued that it's the other way around, and that we get them written down first in the Hippocratic texts because we don't have anything Iranian of a similar nature and comparable or greater age. But in fact, Hippocratic medicine takes place in Ionia, emerges in Ionia at a period that is under Achaemenid rule. And the Ionian Greeks work with constructs that they adapt from the much more powerful, much more prestigious, you know, possibly also much more learned Persians. Now, that means you have to imagine sources in Iran that do not survive or never assumed written form that go back before the 5th century BCE. I think that's possible. But it's speculation. And the argument is all caught up with cultural prestige. Good Europeans want to insist on the primacy of the Greeks. Good Asians and anti-Orientalists want to insist, no, it wasn't that way. The Greeks, you know, tell a good story and think they invented everything, but by God, they're dependent on the Persians. And for reasons of contemporary politics, I think it's more important to observe just what has been loaded into that debate rather than taking sides on one or the other. Is that a sufficient answer?
Yeah. I had a question about linguistics.
Sure.
And if we can look at the Indo-European root of Magush, which mm-hmm. apparently does occur in Achaemenid source material, then do we have a sense of what we can, or can we glean anything from that particular?
We don't have any verbs mm-hmm. that are built on that root.
Okay.
What we have is one noun, Magush, mm-hmm. and some adjectives that occur within Magavan and a few others, that occur within the context of sacrificial ritual, apparently to describe the process of triangular reciprocity mm-hmm. among priest, king or patron, and gods.
Okay.
And Almut Hintze is the one who really has worked this out most thoroughly,
okay.
building on Hans Peter Schmidt and Jean Quellens. I find it utterly convincing, but you know, the evidence for Magush, Magavan, there's lots of evidence. Magush, the evidence is much slimmer.
Okay, thanks.
So some of the dictionaries list Mach as Proto-Indo-European possible root, which means to do, I think, or to have power or something like this. Is that a dubious? and which is also the root, apparently, of machine, of mechanics, mech, right?
You know,
might, may, right?
It's phonologically possible, but none of the terms in Indo-Iranian really mean that, and so I would resist it myself. You know, it's a plausible suggestion at the level of phonology. At the level of semantics, I just don't think it works. You know, that would let you connect it to all sorts of things in European languages. But their semantic range is very, very different. They don't particularly connect to sacrifice or reciprocity. And so I think we've got two different roots here.
I'm going to ask one more question.
Sure.
If I can. So with Pliny, is there also some kind of reaction against earlier Greek practices, like, you know, the pre-Socratic, you know, Pythagorean number mysticism and geometric, you know, worship of geometric shapes and so on? Or does that not figure into understandings of magic?
He blames Democritus rather than Pythagoras. Others writing about magic do take the tack that you're suggesting. I've forgotten if he makes Democritus a pupil of Pythagoras as well as of Zarathustra. I think not. Really, the lineage he wants to trace is Zoroaster, Democritus into the West. And he puts it at the precise moment that medicine is also taking shape. And Pythagoras, I don't remember. I'd have to check to be sure. I mean, the book is long, and I've only focused on the portions of it that deal with the Kairokmeta. Pythagoras probably gets named at some point, but I don't remember his playing a crucial role.
But that tradition is out of favor. A kind of Pythagorean tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know that it's demonized in quite the same way. I mean, this is very polemic, very invective. It's not just, you know, made some mistakes. This is the root of all evil. Anything else? Yeah?
When do the Magi in this form, as Persian priests or peddlers of Eastern goods, when do they disappear from the record?
We're still talking about them, I think. Yeah. I mean, they don't disappear completely ever. Magi and magic remain, you know, connected. It ceases to be a topic of hot interest, probably with the fall of the Roman Empire. Some of the church fathers continue, you know, to polemicize after that, but it's nowhere near as important. The earliest attestation of that is a fragment of Heraclitus in the 5th century, where he groups the mage, and it's just a list of, you know, kind of scurrilous religious types he doesn't like, and magi appear in that list, with night walkers and fortune tellers and bacchantes and other such things. And that's the earliest that we see it. Yeah.
To know that Zoroaster is specifically attacked in the Witch Hunter's Handbook as the origin of magic and witchcraft.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And Witch Hunter, you mean the Malleus Maleficarum? Yeah. Well, that comes straight out of Pliny and others. Yeah.
But you're asking like, it's still, like they're yeah. still talking
still,
about
and
it.
That's what 16th century I think and magic still has this sense of oriental wizards. I mean, there is a mixed credulity and suspicion about those foreigners who do weird things that, you know, if you're really sick and desperate you might go to them for acupuncture or what have you. Anything else? Okay. Thank you all.
Thanks so much.